Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. The road trip for Rabbi David Levenkreuz, a faculty member of Pardes, continues. He'll be speaking this coming Shabbat, May 5th, in San Francisco, then on Sunday in Los Angeles, on Monday, May 7th, in Philadelphia and in Washington, D.C., and then this coming Tuesday, May 8th, in New York City. I urge you, if you're in one of those cities, to check out the details from the flyer that was sent as a previous podcast transmission to sign up and come to one of his talks. This week, Rabbi Meir Schweiger discusses Parshat Emor. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior faculty member of Pardes and serves as the Mashkiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Schweiger.
This week's Parsha is Parshat Emor. I would like to dedicate today's podcast to the memory of my mother-in-law, Chava bat Avraham Tzvi, whose yahrzeit is this evening. Today I would like to focus on chapter 23, verses 10 to 22, the section of the Omer, the counting of the Omer. We begin in verse 10, where it says, "Speak to the Jewish people and say to them, when you will come into the land which I am giving you, and harvest its harvest, you shall bring the Omer, the first of the harvest, to the priest. And he will wave the Omer before God, to your benefit, mimochorat haShabbat, on the morrow of the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it. And you shall do on the day of the waving of the Omer, you shall bring a sheep as a burnt offering, and a meal offering, and an accompanying wine libation. And in verse 14, and bread and parched corn you shall not eat until that very day, until the time that you bring the sacrifice of God. This shall be an everlasting statute for all generations in all your dwellings." What is this offering? Let us note that Omer would seem to be a measure. And in fact, we find at the end of chapter 16, in the very last verse, in the book of Exodus, the Omer is a tenth of an ephah. The Omer is the amount of manna that was given to the Jewish people as their daily portion of food. And in our section, we are told that we have to now take an Omer, the equivalent of a daily portion, an Omer of the first cutting, and bring it to the temple as an offering to God. In verse 14, we're told that the Jewish people are not allowed to eat of the new produce until they have brought this offering to God. In rabbinic literature, this is known as the Isur Chadash, the prohibition of eating from the new produce until the Omer has been brought. And in a period, in a time, when we have no temple, when there is no Omer which is brought, there is a prohibition to eat the new produce until the second day of Pesach has passed. The Omer was brought from the first harvest. And in the land of Israel, the barley ripens before the wheat, so that the first harvest is the barley harvest. And hence the Omer is brought from barley. Barley, which in the rabbinic understanding is normally seen as animal food, Wheat, on the other hand, is seen as the food of human beings. The Mishnah in Masechet Rosh Hashanah says that there are four times during the year when the world is judged. On Pesach, for the produce. On Atzeret, Shavuot, for the fruits of the tree. And in the Talmud, it says, how do we know that, in fact, the world is judged regarding the produce? Because God said, bring the Omer on the second day of Pesach as a way of pacifying me. Or as it says in verse 11, Lirtzonchem, to bring your goodwill before me. If you bring the Omer, this will be a way of pleasing me, so that I will see to it that the harvest will be very successful. As we know in the land of Israel, those of us who are living here, the period between Pesach and Shavuot, climactically, is a very turbulent period. There is this constant movement from periods of heat waves to periods of potential rainfall. And the instability of the climate perhaps reflects the judgment which is going on. Even if there is an abundance of grain growing in the fields, the grains need warm weather, the heat, in order to fully ripen. If in the midst of the harvest of the grain, there is a serious rainfall, it can totally destroy the harvest. So that, when the harvest begins, it is important to petition God to bring about the proper climatic conditions that will make the harvest successful. And then we are told, you shall count on the day following the Sabbath, from the day that you bring the Omer, seven Sabbaths, complete Sabbaths. Until the end of the seventh Sabbath, you shall count 50 days. And bring a new meal offering to God. And this new meal offering, in verse 17, are two loaves of bread which are waved. Two loaves that are made out of solet, fine flour, wheat flour. Chametz teafena, that are baked to be chametz. Bikurim Lashem, first fruits for God. This new meal offering which is brought 50 days later, on the day that we know from other sources, in Deuteronomy chapter 16, Chag HaShavuot, the festival of weeks. This new meal offering in rabbinic literature is known as Shtei HaLechem. And as I read a few moments ago, from the Mishnah in Masechet Rosh Hashanah, chapter 1, Mishnah 2, on Shavuot we are judged regarding the fruits of the tree. And once again in the Talmud, on this Mishnah, it says, God said, bring before me the Shtei HaLechem, and with that, I will judge you favorably regarding the fruits. And in fact, we know that the holiday of Shavuot introduces a period when the first fruits are brought to the temple. The first fruits that are brought from the seven species. The first fruits that are brought from the products of the trees, the choice trees of the land of Israel, so that the Shtei HaLechem is a way of petitioning God. Enable our harvest of the bounty of the land of Israel to be blessed. And in fact, we read in Deuteronomy, in chapter 16, verse 9 and 10, which parallels our section. 7 weeks you shall count from the moment you put the sickle to the standing wheat. Begin to count 7 weeks. And then you will celebrate the holiday of Shavuot according to the tax imposed upon you, the gift of your hand which you will give as God blesses you. And this could very well be an allusion to the first fruits which we're supposed to bring to the temple, the generosity of our hands reflecting the blessing of God in our harvest. It is very interesting that in our section, the period of the Omer, which links the holiday of Pesach with the holiday of Shavuot, is in its essence an agricultural festival, a link between the first meal offering, the Omer, and the second meal offering, the Shtei HaLechem. The second meal offering, which ushers in the bringing of the Bikurim, and according to the rabbinic understanding, the second offering allows the bringing of the new produce into the temple, so that if the Omer allows people to eat the new produce in their backyard, wherever they are, and not only the barley, but the wheat as well, the Shtei HaLechem allows people to bring the new produce to the temple for the meal offerings that will be given to God. The period of the Omer is a celebration of the bounty of the land of Israel. It is a period of expressing our gratitude to God for all that He has given us. A period where we petition God to bring us blessing, which we don't take for granted. If I go back to the verse in Joshua chapter 5, verse 11, we are told that when the Jewish people enter the land, the first thing which they did was to celebrate the festival of Pesach, bring the Paschal Lamb. And then we're told in verse 11, and they eat of the new produce of the land on the morrow of Pesach. Matzot, on that very day. And in the next verse, verse 12, and the manna ceased on the following day when they began eating from the produce of the land. In Joshua we see the transition which occurred, the transition from the desert to entering the land of Israel, from a reality where the Jewish people eat manna, miraculous food which comes to them from the heavens, to a reality where they will now eat from the natural produce of the land. But the movement, perhaps, is to indicate to the Jewish people that their eating from the produce of the land is no less miraculous, no less a gift of God than the manna which they received in the desert. And perhaps this is why we offer up the Omer. The Omer which in the desert was associated with the manna, the miraculous gift from the heavens, and using the same measure, bring the new harvest, no less a miraculous gift of God. In order to be able to receive the blessing, it is necessary for us to recognize how indebted we are to God, how dependent we are on God. And as I mentioned earlier, as much as we plant, as much as we work the land, with all of our efforts, there are elements which are still beyond our control. We still need the right climatic conditions. And especially during the harvest period, we need the heat to help the produce ripen, to come to its full actualization. It is very interesting that the counting of the Omer and the actual bringing of the Omer was the basis of a major dispute between the Sadducees and the Pharisees in the Second Temple period. The Sadducees said that the Omer is to be brought Mimocharat HaShabbat, the day following Shabbat. The Sadducees, who interpreted the Torah in its most literal way, said that the Omer always had to be brought on the first Sunday following the beginning of Pesach. Hence, if we then go on to count the days 50 days later and celebrate the festival of Shavuot, Shavuot always falls 7 weeks later on a Sunday. And the rabbis, who were the reflection of the Pharisee school, said that Mimocharat HaShabbat does not mean Sunday, but the second day of Pesach, as we see in the verse in Joshua. Pesach, or for that matter, any festival, is a Shabbat, because it is a day of cessation of work. And hence, the Omer did not have to be brought on a Sunday, but could be brought on any day of the week, as long as it was the second day of Pesach. And as an extension of that, the holiday of Shavuot could fall any day of the week. If we examine this dispute between the Sadducees and the Pharisees, it may actually reflect a much deeper dispute between the two, which Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch discusses. The Sadducees focus on Shabbat. Shabbat as the reflection of the God of creation, and hence see the period of the Omer as a time to celebrate nature. The Pharisees connected with Pesach. Pesach, which reflects God's intervention in the natural order, a God of history, not only of a God who created the natural world, but of a God who is constantly intervening, who in fact intervenes in the natural order to have it correlate to our actions, so that the period of the Omer highlights the ongoing relationship between God and the world, a relationship where God wants to have the natural order correlate to our actions. A world in which we acknowledge the gift of God and God reciprocates by bringing us blessing, so that the natural world becomes the interface of a dialogue between God and the Jewish people, God and the world, a very dynamic relationship. So if I sum up what we have in this section, the period of the Omer is very much connected with the sanctification of this time, insofar as it reflects the sanctity of the land, the gift of the land, the blessing of the land. We acknowledge, we sanctify this period by bringing two offerings at the beginning and at the end, to acknowledge from beginning to end, this is the gift of God. But note that after we are told of proclaiming this day as a holiday, the day of Shavuot, in verse 21, we are then told in verse 22, and when you harvest the harvest of your land, do not completely harvest the ends of your field. Do not gather all the things in your field. Leave it for the poor and the stranger, which means that our acknowledgement of the gift of God is not only reflected in the sacrifice we bring to God, but in our social consciousness, in our recognizing that this harvest also belongs to the poor. We have a responsibility of social justice, of social equality, of making sure that everyone is provided for. And this theme is highlighted in Numbers when it speaks about Shavuot and says in Numbers chapter 16, verse 11, and you shall rejoice before the Lord your God, you and your son, your daughter, your servant, your maid, the Levi in your gate, the stranger, the orphan, the widow, in the place which God has chosen. Our rejoicing brings together the place which God has chosen with the stranger, the poor, the orphan, the widow. Our relationship with God is very much interwoven with our sense of social responsibility. We know that the period of the Omer took on a different character. We already see this perhaps in the period of the Mishnah, but even more so in the Middle Ages. Namely, the period of the Omer was seen as a period of mourning. And in rabbinic literature, we find that on the one hand, the mourning is associated with the students of Rabbi Akiva who died during this period. And according to one tradition, Lag BaOmer, the 33rd day of the Omer, is a day of celebration because on that day they stopped dying. We know all too well that in the Middle Ages, during the time of the Crusades, there were a number of Jewish communities that were devastated during this period of the Omer. Hence, the mourning. I want to focus on this aspect of the period of the Omer and look at a verse which appears in our parsha, chapter 22, verse 32. Do not desecrate my holy name, and I will be sanctified in the midst of the Jewish people. I am the Lord your God. This verse seems to be a prohibition directed to the general Jewish population. In fact, we have an interesting parallel in the beginning of our parsha directed to the priests, when it says in chapter 21, verse 6, "They shall be holy to God, their God. They shall not desecrate the name of their God, because the fire of God, the bread of their God, they are offering, and they shall be holy." Once again, there is a prohibition: do not desecrate God's name. It is very interesting that in Masechet Yoma, at the very end, page 86a, in the section that speaks of Yom Kippur and Teshuvah, there is a brayta which says that if one sins and there is the element of desecration of God's name, they are not fully forgiven until they die. As a way of saying that on a certain level, desecration of God's name is the ultimate sin. And perhaps the flip side, sanctification of God's name, is the ultimate mitzvah, commandment to be fulfilled. And the Talmud goes on to ask, but what do we mean by desecration of God's name? And different rabbis give different examples. Rav said, an example would be, if I were to go to the butcher and take meat and not pay immediately. Rabbi Yochanan said, if I were to walk 4 cubits without wearing tefillin, without speaking words of Torah, what is the desecration of God's name? Generally, the commentaries understand that although these rabbis may not have necessarily been doing anything wrong, the problem is a problem of perception. If Rav does not pay immediately, people will draw conclusions and say, he probably won't be paying at all. He probably allows himself to take meat and not pay because of his position, his authority. People may then say, well, if the rabbi can cheat and steal, so evidently it's not so bad. We can also do that. If the rabbi can use his position of authority to get special kickbacks, we can also use our positions, take advantage of them. Rabbi Yochanan, there may have been special circumstances where he is not speaking words of Torah. Yet people will say, evidently, even the rabbi needs a break every once in a while. It's too much to be constantly speaking Torah. So we can also be lax in how engaged we are, so that people of distinction need to be extremely careful of the example which they set, of how people are watching them, and through their example may come to make mistakes and hence behave improperly, bringing about a desecration of God's name. But the Talmud goes on to bring another example. Abaye said, what is desecration of God's name? As we find in a brayta, which says you should love the Lord your God. And what does that mean? This phrase taken from the first paragraph of the Shema, that the name of God should be beloved through you, that one should study the Chumash, one should study Mishnah and Talmud, one should spend their time serving scholars and also be meticulous, careful in their business dealings, in their social intercourse. And the Brita says, if you have a person who is very strict in their religious observance and at the same time is extremely careful in their interpersonal relationships, what do people say about such a person? Fortunate is the one whose father taught him Torah. Fortunate is the rabbi who taught him Torah. Woe to those who do not study Torah. Look at this person. This person who studied Torah. How beautiful are his ways. How correct are his actions. Regarding such a person, God says, this is my servant, Israel, through whom I am glorified. But if one studies, serves scholars, if one is extremely careful in every aspect of their religious observance, but is not honest in their business dealings, does not speak nicely to the people around them, what do people say about such a person? Woe to such a person who studied Torah. Woe to his father. Woe to his teacher. This person who studied Torah, look at how corrupt his actions are. Look at how ugly his ways are. Regarding such a person, it says in the verse from Ezekiel, when the Jewish people will go into exile and be among the nations will say about them, this is the people of God who have been exiled from their land. But that strictness, that care, should have then found its expression in how they related to each other, in the honor that they should have showed each other, the way they spoke to each other. And when there was such a gap between their relationship to God and their relationship to each other, in effect, led to the death of these students. In Kabbalistic literature, in Hasidic literature, the period of the Omer is seen as being a time of introspection, a time of character development, transformation. Every day of the counting is associated with another attribute that one needs to cultivate. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated. Please send your emails to podcast@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.